first office has consented to the retention of the records. Subclause 2 provides that the records of personal information may be retained for periods in excess of those contemplated in the first subclause if it is for historical, statistical, or research purposes. And then, of course, together with that requirement, if the responsible party has established appropriate safeguards against the records being used for any other purposes. Subclause 3 provides that the responsible party that has used the record for personal record of personal information of a data subject to make the decision about the data subject must retain the record for such period as may be required or prescribed by law or a code of conduct, or if there is no law or code of conduct prescribing the retention period, the record must be retained for a period which will afford the data subject a reasonable opportunity to request access to the record. Subclause 4 provides that the responsible party must destroy or delete the record of personal information as soon as reasonably practicable after the responsible party is no longer authorized to retain the record in terms of subclauses 1 and 2. And then the destruction or deletion of the record of personal information in terms of sub 4 must be done in a manner that prevents its reconstruction. Principle 4 deals with the further processing limitation and consists of one clause, namely clause 15, which provides that further processing must be compatible with the purpose of collection. The provision provides that in order to assess maybe I should just start off by saying, Mr. Chair, that in subclause 1, the requirement is that further processing of personal information must be compatible with the purpose for which it was collected in terms of subclause 3. The provision further provides that in order to assess whether further processing is compatible with the purpose of collection, the responsible party must take account of subclause 2A to E, namely the relationship between the purpose of the intended further processing and the purpose for which the information has been collected, the nature of the information concerned, the consequences of the intended further processing for the data subject, the manner in which the information was collected, and then, of course, any contractual rights and obligations between the parties. In subclause 3, Mr. Chen, I'm not going to bore you with the detail. These provisions are to a certain extent a mirror image of what we've already found, but subclause 3 aims to provide us with a list where processing of personal information will not be incompatible with the purpose for which it was originally collected. Principle 5 deals with also a very important aspect of information processing, and that is the quality of information. Clause 16 provides that the responsible party must take reasonable practical steps to ensure that personal information is complete, accurate, not misleading, and updated where necessary. And then subclause 2 provides that in taking these steps referred to, the responsible party must have regard to the purpose for which the personal information was collected or further processed. Principle 6 also consists of one clause only and deals with openness. And this is the requirement that the regulator and the data subject should be notified where personal information is processed. Principle 6 will also find further application in Chapter 6 of our bill. So I'm going to go fairly quickly through the principle itself, Mr. Chair. We'll get to it when we get to Chapter 6 in any event. Subclause 2 provides that if personal information is collected, the responsible party must take reasonable steps to ensure that the data subject is aware of the information being collected, the name and address of the responsible party, the purpose for which the information is being collected, etc. Subclause 3 provides that the steps listed in subclause 2 must be taken if personal information is collected directly from the data subject before the information is collected, unless the data subject is already aware of the information referred to in that subclause 2. Subclause 4 provides that a responsible party that compiles or has compiled a manual and made it available in terms of Section 1451 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act does not have to comply with subsection 1 if all the particulars referred to in Section 51 of the poll, and we'll get to 51, are contained in that manual. So to a certain extent, it's also a form of an exemption that is granted, provided that certain requirements are complied with. I think the remainder of that clause is also self-explanatory, and to a certain extent we've already touched on those principles, and once again subclause 6 is to a large extent a repetition of provisions that we've already found. Principle 7, security safeguards, consists of four clauses. Clause 18, security measures on the integrity of personal information, provides that a responsible party must secure the integrity of personal information in its possession or under its control by taking appropriate measures to prevent, first of all, the loss of, damage to or unauthorized destruction of personal information, and then the unlawful access to or processing of personal information. Subclause 2 also provides that in order to take the steps required in terms of subclause 1, the responsible party must take reasonable measures to identify all reasonably foreseeable internal and external risks to personal information in its possession or under its control, establish and maintain appropriate safeguards against the risks identified, regularly verify that the safeguards are effectively implemented, and ensure that the safeguards are continually updated in response to new risks or deficiencies in previously implemented safeguards. Clause 19 deals with information processed by operators or persons acting under the authority of the responsible party, and in short places the responsibility on the responsible party or the operator to process such information only with the knowledge or authorization of the responsible party, and treat personal information which comes to their knowledge as confidential and must not disclose it, unless they are, of course, required by law to do so. Clause 20 deals with security measures regarding information processed by operators. Subclause 1 provides that the responsible party must ensure that an operator which processes personal information for a responsible party establishes and maintains security measures that are referred to in Clause 18. So if an operator processes personal information on behalf of a responsible party, the obligation is on the responsible party to ensure that that operator also introduces or establishes similar security safeguards that are applicable in respect of the responsible party, him or herself.
Why do I still here? If now there is no law applicable to personal information where the operator resides, what will happen? If there is no law applicable to personal information where the operator resides,
Mr. T, that is. But just to, I'm not sure if this question relates to South Africa or beyond. Do you want to clarify that?
Yes, sir. Subsection 3, subsection 20, subsection 3 says if the operator resides outside the Republic, and then, okay.
Yes, well, I don't think so. I don't know whether I still need to answer the question because we just referred to subclause 3. Does that answer the question?
Subclause 3 isn't question.
Well, that is... Yeah. Sorry.
Qualify it, Chair, and then if now the operator contravenes now this law, and whereas there is no applicable way to domicile.
I think there are one of two possibilities. Either the country where the operator operates has data protection laws, in which case the responsible party must ensure that the operator complies with those laws. If it's in a country where there are no laws, then I think the other, I think it's Section 69 kicks in, where you're not supposed to transfer information to a country that doesn't have adequate data protection, in which case you will then have to do it on a per-contract basis. So I think in both cases the answer will be that the parties between themselves will have to arrange via contract that the... either comply with the laws or comply with the privacy principles. I think so, yeah. Surely then you have to rewrite sub 3. Because sub 3 anticipates a situation where you're domiciled in a place without laws. And because it refers to if any. You must comply with the laws, if any, relating to the protection of information and territory in which you're domiciled. Then this should be changed. I think that those are the two possibilities. The one, if there are laws, then that is the obligation now on the responsible party to ensure that the operator complies with it. Mm. But what is asked is if any now kicks in and the country doesn't have a law, then it will be dealt with by the other section. Mm. But if there are laws, the other section is not applicable, so you need this thing.
On that one. I mean, I think it's clear cut if there are laws, but how many countries, I can't remember from your presentation, I mean, very few have. In Africa there are 4, and you know, if you look at the way, I don't know if it's relevant, the teleoperating bodies, you know, go all over the globe, you could find people setting up shop in Gaborone, because there are no laws. And so I think I would agree that I think that section would need to be redrafted because it simply says if any. So it leaves it wide open if there are no laws. And you've got to then find out 69 later on. So it should at least be if a restriction or anyway, that's going on to the drafting, but I just think it's wide open at the moment and confusing.
Perhaps we can just deal with that again when we start with Section 69, because it's actually Section 69 actually deals with the position of transferring information to countries that do not have laws. And this is just one small aspect where the country, in fact, does have a law. The operator must comply, the responsible party has to responsibility to see to it that the contractor complies with that law, if there is a law, and they will most probably do that by way of contract. So it's two two completely different issues. The one is where the country has laws, and the other is where the country doesn't have laws.
Let's flag it and proceed. Let's flag it and move forward until we reach the line. And obviously, the whole act, that's what we've been emphasizing, by the way, for quite a while since we started. Right. Is there another question? From my side. Okay, let's proceed to this.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, Clause 21 deals with the notification of security compromises and provides that where there are reasonable grounds to believe that personal information of a data subject has been accessed or acquired by any unauthorized person, the responsible party or any third party processing personal information under the authority of the responsible party must notify the regulator and then also the data subject in question unless the identity of the data subject cannot be established. Subclause 2 provides that the notification referred to in subclause 1 must be made as soon as reasonably possible after the discovery of the compromise, taking into account legitimate needs of law enforcement or any other measures reasonably necessary to determine the scope of the compromise and to restore the integrity of the responsible party's information system. Subclause 3 provides that the responsible party may only delay the notification to the data subject if the South African Police Service or the National Intelligence Agency or the regulator him or herself determines that notification will impede any criminal investigations. The subclause 4 provides that the notification of a data subject must be in writing and communicated to the data subject in at least one of a number of ways, and that is, among others, to send it by email to the data subject, the last known email address, or even possibly publishing something to that extent in the news media. Or, of course, the regulator may also provide certain guidance and may direct that certain form of notification should take place. Subclause 5 provides that notification must provide sufficient information to allow the data subject to take protective measures against the potential consequences of the compromise, including, if known to the responsibility, the identity of the unauthorized person who may have accessed or acquired the personal information. And then also the regulator may direct a responsible party to publicize in any manner specified the fact that any compromise to the integrity of the confidentiality of personal information has taken place if the regulator has reasonable grounds to believe that such publicity would protect a data subject who may have been affected by the compromise. The final principle, information protection principle, is then data subject participation. Clause 22 deals with access to personal information and provides that a data subject, having provided adequate proof of his or her identity, has the right to request the responsible party to confirm free of charge whether or not the responsible party holds personal information about the data subject, and then also request from the responsible party a description of the personal information about the data subject held by that responsible party, including information about the identity of all third parties or categories of third parties who have had access to the information. If a responsible party then provides that information to the data subject, subclause 2 provides that the data subject must also be advised of the right established in terms of section 23 or clause 23 to request the correction of the information where that information is, of course, incorrect or possibly even inaccurate. Subclause 3 is more of a procedural matter which deals with the fact that if the responsible party requires a fee to be paid for the services to be provided, the responsible party must give the applicant or then the data subject a written estimate of the fee before providing the services, and may require the applicant to pay a deposit for all or part of the fee. Subclause 4 provides that the responsible party may or must refuse, as the case may be, to disclose any information requested in terms of subsection 1 to which the grounds for refusal for access to records set out in the applicable provisions of the PAHIA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act. That act provides for personal information to be refused on a certain ground, and that is why there's an important cross-reference in this bill to the request itself or the refusal of the request. Clause 23 deals with the correction of personal information. So clause 22, you request or you have the right to access that personal information. Clause 23 deals with the correction. So in other words, where the inaccurate or incorrect information or data subject may request the responsible party to correct or delete personal information about him or her in its possession or under its control. When that information is inaccurate, irrelevant, excessive, out of date, incomplete, misleading, or obtained unlawfully, or the data subject may request the responsible party to destroy or delete a record of personal information about him or her that the responsible party is no longer authorized to retain in terms of Clause 14. Clause 24 deals with the manner of access, and it merely refers to the provisions of Sections 18 and 53 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which makes those provisions applicable to requests made in terms of Clauses 22 and 23. In other words, the request for access to personal information or the request for the correction of personal information. That to a certain extent concludes the processing or the information protection principles, but you will recall during our briefing earlier this morning we also referred to processing of special personal information, but I think we're moving in the direction of something that may be regarded as a bit new. So if there are any questions, Mr. Chair, I think we could stop here.
Let me just, I know that I'm now slightly running ahead to the regulator section, but I just, each of these three sections we've just done raises the question. One way to kick this off is just to ask, are there any jurisdictions where they have comparable laws without having a regulator? Because I take now Clause 21, for example, where there's been a leak or a break in security. Presumably that deals with cases like the one in the UK a few years ago. I remember whole data files from a bank became public knowledge. I forget what the details were, but people's financial records, bank statements, all of this was in the public domain. And now, under our proposed law, the regulator will be directing the responsible party who has suffered the infringement, the security breach, thank you, who has suffered the breach. Yeah, he will direct them or she will direct them to publicize the thing, otherwise how do you know? And the next section, Clause 22, people can go around charging you fees every time you want to access the credit bureau to say, show me what you've got in the blacklisting, I want the details, etc. and these people can actually charge a fee, and under your proposed law, the regulators, presumably, it doesn't say so here, but it, presumably the regulator could step in if they start charging excessive fees. Maybe that's invisible. I'm asking myself throughout whether this thing can work at all without a regulator. And the reason I ask has to do with the same applies to Clause 23. If you tell someone who holds your information that you want correction, deletion, and so forth, I wonder how far you're always going to get unless there's some sort of enforcement body. And then we get to Clause 24, where it says that the PIA provisions on application for requests made in terms of 22 and 23 must be followed. But now you will know, I'm sure, better than we, that the PIA has it's run aground on the it's beached on the rocks of inability or unwillingness of government departments to play, to comply, to give information. The whole point of the PIA is access to information. The whole point of this law is protecting information. Now, certainly government departments haven't been great at giving the access. So the provisions of the PIA there don't work. Now, what is it that makes us think using the same provisions under this law is going to make it work? So the questions really are, can this thing at all be done without this regulator, which you tell us is going to cost $17 million? You know that we, meantime, back on the ranch, we have still been wondering whether we should create an information commissioner within the Human Rights Commission, but that is sort of in abeyance at the moment. So we will need to know from you, must there be a separate regulator? Can this law work without him? And my question about the failure of public bodies, at least, and one must assume that private bodies will be similarly recalcitrant and similarly inclined to charge excessive fees.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sorry. First of all, Mr. Chair, we mentioned very early during our briefing this morning that the central point of the enforcement of this bill will be the regulator. There's no doubt in my mind, and I think the research also indicated to us that you need an enforcement mechanism that functions like the information protection regulator. As far as the $17 million is concerned, we could just possibly indicate at this stage that we should take into consideration that this bill brings with it a huge number of new tasks and responsibilities and functions, irrespective of where that information regulator or those tasks would have ended up. I don't think one would have been able to get past startup costs of at least $17 million. So to a certain extent, I think it will, and I suppose we must be straightforward so that if we haven't got a strong regulator, the same problems will persist. I don't think we'll beat around the bush on that score. I think it's quite obvious that it must be a strong person who would be willing to take up responsibilities in terms of FAIA, because those responsibilities in our schedule, we foresee that we are now going to transfer the responsibilities that the Human Rights Commission has in terms of FAIA to the regulator, together with the responsibilities that he or she will now have in terms of this bill. And it simply remains for the regulator to enforce those provisions to that extent.
Chair, just the principles, the eight principles, you've largely extracted them from, I mean, there are principles in South Africa that you're proposing. You've extracted them from international conventions, but I don't see, looking through the Law Commission report, that there is a universally accepted set of eight principles as far as I can see. You seem to have extracted them from the EU principles, the UN, APEC, and so on. And then you talk about wanting to be principle-based rather than rule-based. But yet, although you list the principles, you then detail each one with rules. So you know, the principle of accountability, this is what it means. So here's a rule, or here's a number of rules. So is there not some contradiction there? You've got this clause, I'm worried about principle one. It's more trying to work out how all these principles fit together. Because effectively, principle one simply says that all the other principles must be complied with. So it's not an equal principle. You don't even really need it. And then, you know, all the measures that give effect to the principles are complied with. What are the measures? And is there not going to be uncertainty with that if a responsible body tries to introduce measures to comply with the principles? But it's a thing of, why have you done it this way? Why don't you, and I don't know what other jurisdictions have done, why don't you put the principles in a general sort of objectives clause where they remain then as principles, and then the detail you put as requirements? Because even though you say that you wanted to go for, reading from the Law Commission report, many jurisdictions regulate privacy by using broad principles rather than the more conventional methods of rule-based regulation. As far as I can see, the detail under each principles are rule-based regulations. So why don't you separate the principles, put them one side, and then have these as requirements, and do away with principle one, because it's effectively saying responsible party must ensure that the following requirements are met. Boom, 1, 2, 3, the 7.
I think what we mean if we say this is, and I must admit that we have, if our legislation is more, term it hybrid legislation, it's not completely principle based, but why we are saying it's principle-based is because it is, and not rules-based, is because it is very flexible and it is supposed to be applicable to so many different sectors. So if it had been rules-based, we would have had a section dealing with education and a section with health and a section with, like they do, for instance, in America, where they have separate sector pieces of legislation dealing with each sector on its own. Even video records, if there's one act specifically dealing with video records because the senator was caught out watching videos that he didn't want people to see, and he was very angry about that, and there was a law made about video records. So in that sense, it's not rules-based, because we do not have the rules for the health sector or the rules for the... Sorry? Well, this must have been a very good one, anyway. But so in that sense, it's not rules based, because you can go a lot further than we have gone. But we have included some rules. I think that why we did it like this is, if you look at the back of the report, you will find the EU directive and the OECD principles, and you will find the actual principles. I think when people talk about, say, principle two, the processing limitations, the exceptions that forms the qualification to that principle, that actually forms the principle. It is not as if there's a principle saying you have to collect the information directly from the data subject, and then you have, you know, exceptions to it, although it sounds funny if I say it like that, but the exceptions forms a part, it's a qualification to the principle, and that actually forms the principle. So the principle is not something separate from the requirements. It is actually that which forms the principle, it's built in. So I think it will definitely make it difficult for other countries to read our legislation if we do it that way, although it's not impossible, I'm sure. And I don't think it may perhaps not impact on our adequacy rating or anything, but I think they will find it difficult to read, because this is the way in which it's been dealt with in other pieces of legislation as well. This is the sort of the accepted, and this is also, if you look in the EU directive, you will find it very much, you know, we've changed it to fit in with our own circumstances and also with the submissions that we've received during 5 years and so forth. So it has changed, but you will definitely be able to see the correlation between our bill as it is now and the EU directive, you know, as it was originally enacted. Insofar as principle one is concerned, the other principles do not, that is actually a separate principle. In the, you know, that is one of the principles is accountability. And it tells you who is the responsible person. So we, you know, I know that just as it is written, it would be impossible. We will, you know, it doesn't say who must process the information lawfully in the other principles, and therefore, just in so far as drafting is concerned, you need the principle for that reason. But of course, you can fit that in the other principles. But then you will lose one of your principles, which is one of the 8 accepted international principles. So accountability is one of the principles. So if you don't have that as a separate principle and you just say, in, for instance, principle 2, the responsible party must process the personal information lawfully, I don't think it will make any difference, but then you will not have that that principle as a separate principle anymore. So...
Yeah, look, I think my problem is, I mean, my understanding of a principle is that it's something broad. It's not specific, not detailed. It's a broad, over-encompassing, wide thing. So accountability is a principle. You don't specify what it is. The need, you know, there needs to be accountability. I think everybody knows what that means. What you have then done with the sections, so your principles are almost your headings. But if one says, what is the principle of purpose specification, is it just the heading purpose specification, or is it clauses 12, 13, and 14? And you can't tell me that the detail in 14 is a principle. And that's why I'm saying I have a bit of a difficulty with this thing of combining the principles with rules. Okay, because the fact that you must, where is it, you must... you know, the requirements under notification to the regulator, they're not principles. So I'm asking myself, what is the principle and what is the requirement? To my mind, the principle is the heading. Okay? The requirement then is the detail. It can't be the principle. And that's why I'm arguing the separation.
Is it not that... there could be various ways in which you articulate principles. There are instances where you simply throw a sentence to the principle. There are instances where you take an effort to explain the nature of the application of that principle. My sense really is that, I need to be clarified, is that here I don't consider these to be rules. I consider them as clarification of guiding on how to implement that particular principle. Like sometimes when you apply the law of what is just and equitable, there are, in particular instances, an explanation on how that principle is applied. Some people will choose to put it, you apply just and equitable. Others would explain how you apply, what you consider when you apply that. It is that context in which I say this.
A very high-level intellectual debate. I just want to just say, you know what, I think elements of this draft are borrowing from other drafts. The EU draft in particular, you've referred to it many times. It may well be that it influences what we are trying to do so that we communicate with whoever is interacting with our law. Maybe you want to come in with that. Yeah, please.
Surely these should all be read as legal obligations which are being imposed, which is maybe we're confusing things by calling them principles or calling them this, that, or the other, but these are obligations that are being imposed. And just thinking on the matter of following the international instruments, I'm not sure what the gesticulation means. It does make sense in this world. We did the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act on the same model. It's too many years ago now for me to remember exactly how it reads in my head, but it was based on the EU. And because you're dealing with electronic commerce, but many other fields of endeavor on the internet and transnationally, it really does help. People have said to me in respect of the ECT that it really does help when you're dealing with a recognizable incarnation of the instruments that are used on every continent, because by its very nature, business in particular, but also other endeavors, academic, medical, professional, they do flow across our borders. So it really does help if you have recognizable statutes.
Before that, I mean, I think I've sort of worked out a bit what you've done. The principles are the headings, okay? The detail underneath them is the measures to give effect to the principles, okay? Now, the difficulty is that you've then got a principle of openness. What is contained under Principle 6 is then the how to give effect to that principle. But you haven't really clarified what that principle of openness is. It's just a word. And so I just, you know, it's something to think about, but I just think that this combination of the one-word principle and the detail of how it's going to be implemented is confusing.
I think what we must just be careful, I think if we talk about principle-based legislation, it doesn't mean that our legislation has principles in it and then refer to these eight principles or whatever. It's actually two separate things. It's confusing, perhaps. The principles, the information protection principles, and these are the ones that are included in our Act, if something has a sort of a meaning of its own worldwide, internationally. If you talk about the openness principle, then it will include everything that we have under 17. And that's why I'm saying it's the qualification forms part of the principle, and that is really, it's not meant to mean the ordinary meaning of principle. When we say this is principled legislation, we're talking about something different. It wasn't necessary to have any specific principle in the legislation to talk about principle-based legislation. You know, we could have called it anything else. It's just a coincidence that internationally everybody calls these rules principles, and that we're also talking about the concept of principle-based legislation. So the principle-based legislation is just the fact that we have sort of a framework that is applicable to many different sectors. That's what we mean by that. It doesn't have any sort of relationship to the fact that we actually have something in our Act that we call principles.
Well, that's what you're saying. So we are illiterate here. You are teaching us like ICT language. What she's saying basically is there are trying to make sense of what the explanations that are coming through, because, you know, I mean, if you take your youngster to give him this computer, right, with SMS, it's a different language altogether. Yeah. That's the explanation, the gist of what you said, really. Yeah, enough. So I think we should forge ahead, and the idea is to interrogate this so that we understand them as we interrogate them. We'll come back and make inputs into the final draft now going close by close, ourselves on our own, after the briefing. So let's interrogate Scott. Let's trust us. Yeah.
But sorry, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to show, is that principle-based and these principles are not the same thing. These could have been called rules or objects or you could obligations or whatever. Yeah. It's just a coincidence that worldwide people are calling them principles. But it could have been another name. But it would still be principle-based legislation because it is not, we don't have rules for every sector and rules for, it doesn't go down deep enough to be rules-based. It's just sort of overarching legislation.
I think the thing still for me is that what is here is measures to give effect to the principles, not principles themselves. Anyway, I'll leave it.
Thank you, Chair. Part B deals with obligations in respect of the processing of special personal information. Clause 25 does nothing else than gives us an indication of what special personal information is. So to a certain extent, and I'm even scared using this word now, but it's a definitional clause. Mr. Chair, thank you. Clause 25 provides that unless specifically provided by the clauses that follow, a responsible party may not process personal information concerning a child who is subject to parental control in terms of the law, or then a data subject's religious, philosophical beliefs, race or ethnic origin, trade union membership, political opinions, health, sexual life, or criminal behavior. The reason why these are defined as special personal information is that there's general agreement that certain categories of information are so part of your privacy that they should enjoy special protection. I am not going to bore you with the detail of clauses 26 to 31, but I'll maybe just give you a general indication of the general trend of those provisions. Clauses 26 to...
Yes, I just wanted to... Maybe it has to do with the explanation that it has been given that it's good for us to have a law that is going to be understood by the international community. But here we have other philosophies besides, I mean other beliefs besides religious beliefs and philosophical beliefs, we have cultural beliefs. Would there be any reason for the exclusion of that kind of belief as a basis for not giving kind of information that may be required?
Add mine. And I would like to know why trade union membership has been elevated to the level of category of religious or philosophical beliefs or political opinions, etc. Why is this? It's the first time I've seen that.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
It's a different, I mean, the definition of personal information is a different set of categories, and it is then interesting what have you picked and what have you left out. And why? So I think some of the points have been raised. I mean, I even reading clause 30, I'm not quite sure what sexual life means. There's no definition of it, and no, it's not. I mean, sexual orientation is one thing. Sexual life would be whether you visit prostitutes or whatever. So it's broader, but there's no definition of it. And then I think linked to that is with something which I'd wanted to raise before, and I'm here, I'm leaving now, so maybe just to raise it now, the personal information. That what is the difference between race and color and gender and sex? Because you have them under personal information as two different categories. And I would have thought, when you talk about race, you mean color. I mean, is it going to be that, Chair, with respect, those from the northern part of the country tend to be darker than those in the southern part? So is that what is meant by color? And what's the difference between gender and sex, which you have in under the personal information? But anyway.
Gender and sex.
Well, race and color. I mean, is it
red, black?
No, I mean, the question is good though, because it's like the section 9 of the Constitution. Let's.
There's a big difference between sex and gender. Because gender is a social construct. One can still have male features that define themselves as a woman. What is seen as a woman because it's a social construct.
Every nation is wrong by defining two people based on their gender. Tell me if their sex and gender is different. Race and color?
Why did you take particular things and not others?
I think, yes, just to get back to that, it does come from the Constitution and CIPI as well, the definition of personal information. I think, you know, you may have a point insofar as some of these choices are concerned. It was determined by choices that have been made in other countries, but it's not the same for every country. So we did include the ones that we think was important. It also comes from directly from the EU directive. I must say the section on trade union membership, that was in and out, and debated a lot because of this. Yes, well, you know, sometimes people were... It was, you know, some people thought it was important and that there were problems in persons belonging to a specific trade union or whatever, and that needed it. So it is in the EU directive, so we included it in this bill. But I know that, you know, there was a lot of debate about that, so I'm not sure myself whether that should be included. Insofar as the Section 26, the religious, philosophical, and cultural beliefs are concerned, I think there would be no problem in including it there. It will fit in perfectly because that is the religious, philosophical beliefs can also include cultural beliefs. So I don't think that would be problematic to include that in there. It is just the decision needs to be taken as to whether it needs stricter regulation, whether it's a problem for people, and then the definition of sexual life. I think that would be a good idea to have a
yes, Mr. Chair. Sexual life. Where shall we start?
Just realize criminal behavior. What is that? You mean criminal record? But criminal, you know, details. Data subjects criminal behavior, what? That they're alleged to go stealing, alleged. You know, person's innocent until proven guilty. What's criminal behavior? So I think you mean maybe criminal record where they've been convicted. But does it mean that they've been arrested? Is that criminal behavior? Arrested and then the charges withdrawn. I think I've also got a problem with criminal behavior.
I just think that one should think about that carefully because I think it's mostly where you haven't been arrested and it's been alleged and then that information is still being kept because that is the case at the moment. And that you've never been... History may be...
If it's records like, for example, the number of times I was, say, arrested by the police, but each time the police withdrew the charges... That's not criminal behavior. It might be, there must be some other category because it's implying then that I'm a criminal, whereas a person's innocent until proven guilty. So I think it's just the terminology that's an issue.
But I think it's a wider a principle that we're trying to address. It's not only people that have been convicted or arrested or whatever. It's sort of all any information that can be to your detriment if people use that as if it's a fact. You know.
I think we have made our point. I accept the point, the observations. We flag it. When we redraft ourselves, we'll debate that term. Yeah. I think we have clarified what the drafters want to say to us. Yeah. So let's put it.
Thank you, Chair. As I mentioned, the general prohibition contained in clause 25 is subject to certain exemptions in clauses 26 to 31. The general trend of these exemptions can be explained with reference to a few clauses, and I'm not going to bore you with the detail of all the clauses with your permission, because there is a general trend. Clause 26, for example, creates certain exemptions in respect of the processing of personal information concerning a data subject religious or philosophical beliefs if such processing is carried out by spiritual or religious organizations in respect of their own members. Clause 28, for example, provides that a trade union of which the data subject is a member may process the information concerned if such processing is necessary to achieve the aims of the trade union. And then clause 30, for example, provides, among others, that special personal information regarding a data subject's health or sexual life may be processed by medical professionals, healthcare institutions, or social services if such processing is necessary for the proper treatment and care of the data subject. Clause 32 reflects a general exemption with regard to the prohibition in respect of the processing of personal information. The clause provides that the prohibition contained in clause 25 does not apply if the processing is carried out with a prior parental consent where the data subject is a child and is subject to parental control in terms of the law. Processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in law, or where processing is necessary to comply with an obligation of international public law, or the regulator has granted the authority in terms of Section 34 for the processing in the public interest, and appropriate guarantees have been put in place in law to protect the data subject's privacy, or insofar as clause 25B is concerned, clause 25B, of course, dealing with everything, any type of special information except that of a child, if that information processing is carried out with the consent of the data subject, all the information has deliberately been made public by the data subject. That brings us to Chapter 4, which is a very short chapter and deals with the exemption from the information protection principles. Clause 33 provides that processing of personal information is not in breach of an information protection principle if the processing is authorized by the regulator in terms of clause 34. And then clause 34 provides us with the necessary guidance in order to determine how the regulator should provide that exemption, and provides that an exemption will generally be granted if it is in the public interest or the public interest in the processing outweighs to a substantial degree any interference with the privacy of a data subject that could result from such processing, or the processing involves a clear benefit to the data subject or a third party that outweighs to a substantial degree any interference with the privacy of the data subject or a third party that could result from such processing. Clause 2 aims to define or explain to us, which is not a closed list, but gives us guidance with regard to what should be regarded as public interest, the term public interest. Once again, Mr. Chair, they are listed, and I don't think it's necessary for me to bore you with the detail thereof. And then subclause 3 provides that the regulator may impose reasonable conditions in respect of any authorization granted in terms of subsection 1. Chapter 5 brings us to the supervision provisions and mainly deal with the establishment and the creation of the Information Protection Regulator. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, could we possibly just ask for a short recess? You are you're driving us hard.
No. You know what? I want us to agree on going forward. But there's also a limit to the listening capacity of people. We have put together 2 days to deal with this. How far are we? Halfway, or
Chair,
or beyond halfway.
In an hour's time, we will be halfway, Chair.
You know what that?
Yes, Chair.
Yeah, then we can take recess, and 4 o'clock we stop. Give ourselves time to go and absorb what we have just had today, and then tomorrow we'll meet maybe 9 o'clock. Not maybe 9 o'clock tomorrow. Because it's Wednesday, nobody's traveling from far. We're all here. So we can meet 9 o'clock tomorrow. Hopefully by lunchtime we'll have finished with this. Yeah, let's take a break, 5 minutes.
In part A, dealing with the creation of the Information Protection Regulator, I'm going to go fairly quickly, with your permission, through these clauses because, first of all, the regulator will be a independent statutory authority. So most of these provisions we find in existing legislation dealing with the mechanisms behind establishing an information protection regulator or a commission or any statutory authority. So Part A consists of clauses 35 to 47, which aim to regulate matters dealing with the establishment of the information protection regulator. Clause 35 provides that the regulator will be an independent statutory authority. The remaining provisions of this part, Mr. Chair, deal with, for example, in Clause 36, the constitution of the regulator and the period of office of the members thereof. And I'm just merely, with your permission, going to highlight a few important provisions in that clause for you. For example, paragraph F provides that no person will be qualified for appointment as a member of the regulator if that person is a member of the legislature, is a councillor of a local authority, is an unrehabilitated insolvent, or it is clause 36F. 36.1F, Mr. Chair. Just to highlight some of the important provisions thereof. But as you see, they are generally found in various pieces of legislation. Subclause 2, for example, provides that the members of the regulator must be appointed by the President and must be persons approved by Parliament after considering proposals made by interested parties in terms of Clause 4. Subclause 5 provides that the members of the regulator will be appointed for a period of not more than 5 years and will, at the expiration of such period, be eligible for reappointment. If we can move to Clause 37, which deals with the remuneration, allowances, benefits, privileges of the members of the regulator, I think the important thing to note here is that the minister will determine the remuneration and allowances of the members in consultation with the Minister of Finance. Clause 38 provides for the administrative support of the regulator. The heading thereof is the secretary and staff then of the regulator. It is possibly important to note there that the secretary and the support staff of the regulator will be appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. Subclause 2, for example, makes provision that the regulator may, with the approval of the minister and after the minister has consulted with the Minister of Finance, employ certain experts in temporary capacities to assist the regulator with specific tasks as and when that is necessary. Clause 39, dealing with committees of the regulator. Subclause 1 provides that the regulator may, if it considers it necessary for the proper function performance of its functions, establish a working committee which must consist of such members of the regulator as he or she may designate, establish such other committees as it may deem necessary, and which must consist of such members of the regulator as the regulator may designate, or such members of the regulator as the regulator may designate, and other persons appointed by the minister for the period determined by the minister. Subclause 4b, for example, provides that any function so performed by the working committee referred to in subclause 1 will be deemed to have been performed by the regulator. And in terms of subclause 5, the regulator has the power to dissolve any committee established by the regulator at any time. Clause 40, I think, is straightforward, Mr. Chair. It deals with the meetings of the regulator. Clause 41, dealing with the funding of the regulator, I think the important issue to note here is that Parliament will appropriate annually for the purpose, for the use of the regulator, of such sums of money as may be necessary for the proper exercise, performance, and discharge by him or her of his or her powers, duties, and functions under the Act, and also the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And then clause 42, I think the important issue to note there is that the regulator and any person acting on behalf or under the direction of the regulator is not civilly or criminally liable for anything done, reported, or said in good faith in the exercise or performance of any power or duty or function of the regulator in terms of this piece of legislation as well as the Promotion of Access to Information.
I just want to clean something a little bit. My God. Just Lord. 36. Yeah. I think we just need to streamline who really appoints the regulator. I can see we're moving from president to parliament to minister. And so that's what we just want to address at some point. It's just to bring it to your notice. Just go ahead.
Would you allow me to tell us just what the thinking was in the way they've done it? Since they, the people did the drafting. clearly you have in mind a fully independent regulator, because you've used the same terminology used for the courts and for the chapter 9. It's subject only to the constitution and the law, must be impartial and perform functions without fear, favour, or prejudice, all of the identical terminology. But then, precisely the chairperson's point, we're really trying to find out your thinking. When you say the minister invites interested parties to nominate, you say Parliament must approve, but you're silent on who selects. Are you saying Parliament only gives the nod after the minister has selected from the nomination? Are you saying, by contrast, that Parliament must do the shortlisting, interviewing, and recommendation, as it's called in some instances, or advice to the president and others, and that the president therefore only performs the pure executive function of appointing. But in the same breath, you allow the president to add a few more members, which means it's not independent from the executive. So what was the thinking?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The bill as proposed by the South African Law Reform Commission contains a slightly different provision. However, during our certification process and just really prior to us introducing the bill, we realized that the relevant clause came from legislation which provided a certain appointment mechanism which is not really in line with parliamentary procedures at this stage. So this is really where we would like to get guidance from the committee, especially, and I suppose we are referring to clause 36 and specifically 36.2. Is that the major concern at this stage? Because that is certainly where we would need some guidance with regard to the appointment.
That's clearly said. If there wasn't a concrete reason for all of this, then we will just do our own version, I think.
I would propose that we move, because if you look at, for instance, under the powers, if you say to make public statements in relation to the matter affecting this exercise, and you go and say to enforce compliance by public and private bodies, it becomes important who appoints that person, because the independence of that person becomes very, very crucial. This person might be actually be in a position to force compliance by the president, by the ministry, and so on. So that matter of appointment cannot just be taken willy-nilly to protect the independence of that person.
It seems to me, like members are saying, that this is something very close to one of the chapter 9 institutions. So maybe we should, if that becomes possible, keep the consistency of logic. That's why I just highlighted it to say, let's have a look at it, because I understand we are flip-flopping. We are mixing several procedures in one. So if you're asking for guidance, I think from our side, that's the likely direction.
Mr. Chair, let me just to add briefly, and I appreciate, and I mean, we cannot criticize the thinking at this stage. Maybe just to take into consideration that the appointment of the regulator should be done appropriately by the highest authority that this committee would prefer. But one should also take into consideration that there might be matters of urgency during the course of the performance of his or her functions and duties. And I think that is where one would want to have a more streamlined approach, where temporary appointments, persons with appropriate expertise, could be effected fairly quickly. And I think that is where the thinking came in, that the minister should be involved in appointing, if I may say, inverted commas, special members.
The interim board of the SABC board, appointed by the right board here, we are capable of people in Parliament. We are quite capable, I can tell you that.
That is precisely the guidance that I was looking for, thank you, Chief.
Well, the regulator could, we could give the regulator the power to co-opt, as it were, or to hire people for specific purposes.
I think our preference is very clear where we want to go. We'll take it from there and have discussions with the department and so on. But basically, we're moving that particular. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, as far as the powers and duties of the regulator are concerned, the regulator will, in terms of clause 43, it's a very extensive clause with many functions and powers stipulated. Among others, the empowered to monitor and enforce compliance by public or private bodies with the provisions of the bill. The regulator will also be responsible for issuing codes of conduct for different sectors and to make guidelines to assist bodies with the development and application of those codes. Clause 44 aims to require that the regulator must have due regard to certain matters, for example, the protection of all the rights and interests that compete with the right to privacy in the performance of its functions and the exercise of its powers. And then clauses 45 to 47 deal with programs of the regulator, reporting by the regulator, and the duty of confidentiality, respectively. Part B of Chapter 5 consists of two clauses which regulate the duties and responsibilities of information protection officers and the designation of deputy information protection officers, respectively. Information protection officers will, in terms of Clause 48, among others, be responsible for dealing with requests that are made to public or private bodies in terms of the bill. These officers are required to ensure that the public or private bodies of which they are the information protection officers also comply with the provisions of the bill. And then Clause 49 makes provision for the designation by public and private bodies of deputy information protection officers to perform those duties contemplated in Clause 48. The procedure for the designation of deputy information protection officers will be regulated in terms of Section 17 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. That, in brief, concludes Chapter 5.
The information protection officers, will they now exist alongside the information officers, which everybody already is supposed to have, but many don't?
In many instances, it will be one and the same official. It's just two names for one official.
Last for the deal, but 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Chapter 6, which regulates notification in Part A and prior investigation in Part B, relates to two information protection principles. What do we call them at this stage, Chair? Is it still information protection principles?
The principal is not here with us today. He left us at 3 o'clock, so we're fine.
Thank you, Chair. The principles 3 and 6. Principle 3, the purpose specification, and principle 6, openness. Clause 50 places an obligation on responsible parties to notify the regulator before they commence with the processing of personal information. However, subclause 2 requires that the notification referred to in subsection or subclause 1 must be noted in a register kept by the regulator for this purpose. Clause 51 prescribes the particulars, such as the name, address of the responsible party, the purpose of the processing, and the description of the categories of data subject and of the information or categories of information relating thereto that must be contained in the notification. And then subclause 2 provides that a responsible party will only have to give notice once and not each time personal information is received or processed. Clause 52 deals with the exemption in respect of the notification requirement, and the clause provides that the regulator is empowered to exempt certain categories of information processing from the notification requirement. Subclause 4, for example, provides that any exemption granted to a responsible party from the provisions set out in Sections 14 and 51 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act will also apply as an exemption of the notification requirements set out in terms of this legislation. The regulator must, in terms of Clause 53, maintain a register of all notices which he or she must make available to the public. And then Clause 54 creates an offence in respect of any failure to comply with the notification requirement as required in terms of Clause 50. Part B of Chapter 6 regulates prior investigations. Clause 55 requires that the regulator must initiate an investigation before any processing commences. The requirement will be applicable where responsible party intends, for example, to process information in respect of criminal behavior on behalf of third parties or for the purposes of credit reporting. And then Clause 56 regulates matters relating to the prior investigation requirement. The clause, among others, provides that responsible parties may not carry out information processing until the regulator has completed his or her investigation. Mr. Chair, and then maybe just for purpose of your members and yourself, there is just an incorrect reference to Clause 55.3 in Clause 56.1, which should actually read Clause 55.1, but that is something I'm just stating it for your purposes. We can fix that later for you. Chapter 7 is also a very important chapter, and it deals with codes of conduct. The development of codes of conduct will contribute to the proper implementation of the information protection principles as reflected in Chapter 3 of the Bill in each of the different sectors. Clause 57, among others, provides that a code must be must prescribe how the information protection principles are to be applied within specific sectors as far as the processing of personal information is concerned. The remainder of the clauses provide, among others, for the following, Mr. Chair: the regulator may issue codes on his or her own initiative or on application by persons who process personal information, that is Clause 58. Provision is also made in subclause 1, for example, for stakeholder involvement and consultation in the issuing of a code. Clause 59, the regulator must, after a code is issued, publish a notice in the Gazette indicating that the code has been issued and where copies thereof are available, and a code will come into operation 28 days after the publication of the notice in the Gazette. Clause 60 provides that the regulator may from time to time amend or revoke a code that has been issued under Clause 57. The code may prescribe procedures for making and dealing with complaints alleging a breach of the code. If a code sets out procedures for making and dealing with complaints, the regulator must be satisfied that the procedures meet the prescribed standards and any guidelines that may have been issued by the regulator. That was Clause 61. Clause 62 provides that the regulator may provide written guidelines to assist bodies to develop codes or to apply approved codes. Clause 63 deals once again with the regulator, the obligation on the regulator to keep a register of approved codes. Clause 64, the regulator may on his or her own initiative review the operation of an approved code. And then finally, Clause 65, failure to comply with a code is deemed to be a breach of an information protection principle.
Yeah, that brings us to the end of today's presentation. There may be questions around what has just been said now, but otherwise we are most grateful for the department and this work in progress. We finish in tomorrow. Should be present. We should meet here at 9 o'clock. Of course, it depends on the department and also on numbers. What time we finish? Depends on all of us working together with him tomorrow. So tomorrow we meet here. But I would like the members to say a bit, just this traditional bill thing. Should we not just pass that agreement that we want to extend the time? Traditional bills, yeah. Yeah, we have to regulate that. We are convinced we can't pass the law this year. Because you are here, so you must not be free to say. So we are going to be amending the section to extend for a while. Give ourselves a bit more time. Yeah, please.
Just to draft an amendment for you. Oh, is the committee going, the research?
I see Bonani is running around with a paper. I suspect it's an amendment draft.
Oh, really?
No, no, it's not. I think it's a principle. Let's see. What are the, where is it? What? Oh, it's a memo. Yeah. Bonani, just...
Okay, maybe Christine might assist as well, but I spoke to J.B. Kopala, your colleague. I think we had a similar process last year when we were set the deadline, and I was advised that all that we need to do, we take the draft that was used last year, and we just change the dates to whatever the committee would decide.
The department and our sector, including, yeah, the whole department, the ones here and the others who are not here. Let's give ourselves a good time. December next year, we'll have finished anyway. It doesn't mean we have to wait for December.
Yeah.
But I don't want us coming back here and re-amending. Yeah. Good.
I just wanted to request that the bill be made available in the African language.
Very good idea.
Great.
The traditional affairs bill, we'll make a decision to make it available in African languages. But when I was truly on swimming, I'm moving away from that bill to the one we're dealing with. That those of you who would like to visit England, this is the bill that will take us to England. This protection, privacy, and that's our position. Somebody is.